We thank you and commit our ways to you. Amen. So this portion is from the middle of the book of Numbers. This has to do with Korach and his rebellion against Moses and all of those who were involved with him. We're going to talk about something today that we have talked about before. It happens to be a theme I've noticed of much of what Hannah emphasizes in her teaching, and that has to do with appreciating the diversity that exists in God's world. And so this essay is called What Coffee, Chicken Soup, Sorbet, and Laundry Have in Common. So we're going to talk about this. Since I don't really like talking about the same thing very often, we're going to talk about this because this is the subject of the essay, but we're going to talk about it from a little different perspective. At any rate, she writes, there's the water that I drink in my wake-me-up, heavily caffeinated morning mug of hot coffee. There's the water that creates my banish-all-sickness nourishing chicken soup. There's the water in my refreshing store-bought sorbet in my freezer. And there's the water in my washing machine cleaning my soiled laundry. So many different shapes, forms, flavors, and usages. But at the core is the same essential property, droplets of water. People, too, she writes, can appear radically different in diverse situations. But sometimes, if you look closely at the core, you may discover the droplet, their unifying character or quality. For example, the way a person reacts under duress or tension, just as how he chooses to respond in a relaxed mode, can reveal something deep about his approach to life. This is one of the essays we're going to read through and then go back and talk about some of the details. Korach incited a mutiny against Moses. Joining Korach were 250 distinguished members of the community who offered the sacrosanct ketoret, the incense, to prove their worthiness for the priesthood. Now, these members were members of the tribe of Levi, and in this case, other tribes too, but they wanted to prove their worthiness for the priesthood, in spite of the fact that God had spoken previously regarding the priesthood and said it would fall to the descendants of Aaron. There are three Levitical families. Each of them have responsibilities with regard to the tabernacle and later in the temple, but the priests themselves would be descendants of Aaron and then ultimately descendants of Pinchas. At any rate, they claimed that the entire nation, and not just Aaron or the priests, is holy. The earth swallowed the mutineers, and a fire consumed the ketoret offerers. In the aftermath, God commanded that the offering pans be beaten into sheets used to plate the altar. From this passage, the Rebbe comes up with an interesting insight, which we'll talk about in just a second. For they have been offered to God and have become sanctified. The Lubavitcher Rebbe learns an incredible lesson from these copper pans being transformed into the altar on which sacrifices were offered in the tabernacle, God's home. The very metal of these pans was hallowed by an act which was motivated by a holy desire. Though these mutineers acted sinfully and, as a result, were severely punished, beneath their complaint was a desire, however misguided, to come close to God. So from this the Rebbe extrapolates, if such is God's regard for a piece of inanimate metal, certainly no human being is irredeemable, right? This is an interesting insight, Because what he says here is that the mutineers were motivated by a desire to be close to God and to provide their best to the Lord for God's service. Now, that is not the way the mutineers are actually characterized in the text. But his point here is that the copper sheets that they used to offer the Keftoret offerings to the Lord were not consumed in the conflagration that takes place. They are actually beaten into sheets and used to plate the altar, right? So that's kind of an interesting connection he makes here, that even though sometimes people act with inappropriate motives, their actions reflect this deep-seated heart for God, is the insight, and that no human being is irredeemable. For no matter how deleterious his deeds, they hide a desire and striving intrinsic to every creature of God for the goodness and perfection of the design. And this is from his work, Likutei Sichot, which means collected talks. Likutei Sichot is an anthology of the Rebbe's teaching. That, by the way, is available online at Chabad.org in English. At any rate, one short teaching on one verse, on one episode of the Torah. One droplet of wisdom, mind-blowing in its scope. Rather than castigating a sinful group of rebellious, jealous individuals to eternal admonishment, the Rebbe concentrates on their underlying positive motive. Moreover, through this unfortunate episode, he teaches God's infinite love for us, even when we sin or are misguided. And this all-embracing way of thinking, digging and mining in the positive core value, because our world is created by God to serve Him, and everything must therefore have some redeeming value, especially God's chosen people, is intrinsic to how the Rebbe teaches us to view our world. And the people in it, right? That everyone has a redeeming value, and therefore everyone should be treasured. Everyone should be treated as though they were created in the image of God. And so the way we treat people, therefore, doesn't depend on who they are, what color they are, what culture they're connected to, what nation they're a part of, what religious beliefs they hold, right? Everybody is precious to God and therefore should be precious to us. This is an idea which I've mentioned we have talked about before. At any rate, she says one small droplet and one life-altering gestalt. You've probably heard the word gestalt. It's associated with a well-known approach to psychology. Gestalt means, in your footnotes, I have something that is made up of many parts and yet is somehow more than or different from the combination of its parts, right? You've probably heard that expression. Sometimes individuals can work together in such a way that what they're capable of accomplishing is greater than the sum of their parts, right? There's something very special about it. And that's what Hannah is saying here about the Rebbe's insights. It's a life-altering gestalt, an insight, this remarkable perspective that utterly alters how we approach ourselves, each other, and our very world. Okay? So, I want to talk about some of the details. One of the things that I want to talk about, I don't know if you notice this, but in the examples that she provides in the introduction to this essay, what coffee, chicken soup, sorbet, and laundry have in common, I don't know if you noticed that there are four items that she mentions, right? Four items is very common. Four types, four items. If you look at number one, there's the water in my coffee, my chicken soup, my sorbet, and my laundry. Okay? There are many, many examples of the four types being mentioned in rabbinic literature and even apostolic literature. We're just going to talk about a few of them, a couple that you are already familiar with. In Pirkei Avot, Ethics of the Fathers, in chapter 5, paragraph 14, it says, there are four types among those that frequent the house of study, right? But of course, this could apply to anything. There are four types of the righteous individual. There are four types of wicked ones. There are four types of people who give to charity. There are four types here among them that frequent the house of study. The concept or the idea of four types is very, very common in Jewish literature. And these are the four types. He that goes to the house of study, but does not practice. In other words, they study, but they do not practice. He has the reward of his going. Even though his attendance has not yet had the desired result, great is midrash, great is learning, and that it brings one to ma'aseh, to deed. So, there's an anticipation here that the study will find its way into practice. He that practices but does not go, he has the reward of his practicing. He practices the precepts and leads a good life, but does not take the trouble to acquire for himself a first-hand knowledge of the Torah. The third type is he that goes to the house of study and also practices, right? So that, of course, is the righteous individual. This is the ideal. He is a pious man, according to Pirkei Avot. And the last type is he that neither goes nor practices. He is a wicked man, right? So these are the four types that go to the house of study. When we celebrated Passover together and read through the Haggadah, one of the things that we read in the Haggadah regarding Passover has to do with the fact that there are four questions that the celebration of Passover provokes among God's people. There are four questions, and there are also four ways to ask them. The heedless, the foolish, the dull, and the wise. And of course, this is a reflection of the four types of children at the Passover Seder. The heedless child asks, "What is this ceremony of yours?" as though it did not concern him as well. The foolish child asks only what happened, without wanting to know what it means. The dull child doesn't even doesn't see anything to ask about. And the wise child asks, "What is the meaning of everything we do?" And so, of course, in the Seder, it goes on to say, or we say, as those assembled at the Seder, we want to all be like wise children here. We want to know what is the meaning of everything we do. Okay. Here's the four types that give to charity. Among those asked to give charity are four types. He who wishes to give, but does not wish, others to give. He is grudging towards others. He who wishes others to give, but he is himself unwilling to give. He is grudging of his own. He who willingly gives and wishes others to give, he is the pious man. And he who does not give and wishes others not to give too, he's the wicked man. The reason why this is so important is because the four types come up in the parable of the four soils too. And it's not an accident, right? This is another of the indications that this parable that Yeshua tells regarding the four soils is a Jewish parable, because it's organized in exactly the same way as the four types is organized in Jewish literature. That same day, Yeshua told them many things in parables, saying, a farmer went out to sow his seed. As he was scattering the seed, some fell along the path. Right? I mean, based upon this way, the way this farmer sows his seed, you would not expect he gets a great harvest at the end of the day, right? Because he, which is one of the dramatic aspects of the parable, and I would guess it's something that immediately everybody listening to it thought, but that turns out not to be the point. The point is not where the farmer sows the seed. The point is what happens in the hearts of those that the Word of God is sown into. Okay? As he was scattering the seed, some fell along the path. The birds came and ate it. Some fell on rocky places where it did not have much soil. It sprang up quickly, but because the soil was shallow, it didn't last. When the sun comes up, the plants were scorched. They withered because they had no root. Other seed fell among thorns, which grew up and choked the plants. Still other seed fell on good soil, where it produced a crop, 160 or 30 times what was sown, right? Now, there's a big difference between 160 and 30 times what was sown, but the point is that when the word is sown into good soil, it produces fruit, it produces a crop, right? So the four types here are the soil, the seed that fell along the path, the seed that fell on the rocky places, the seed that fell among thorns, and the seed that fell among the good soil. And he concludes the parable by saying, whoever has ears, let them hear. And of course, this is a parable he explains. Let's see. Sorry, it just looked like Bob was trying to get back in. I got a notification, but I don't see it at the moment. Participants? No? Okay. Hopefully he'll be able to connect again. At any rate, the question, of course, is, which type are you? And this is, I think, worthwhile to explore. Are you the wake-me-up, heavily caffeinated morning mug of hot coffee? Are you the banish-all-sickness, nourishing chicken soup? Are you the refreshing store-bought sorbet in my freezer? Are you the washing machine cleaning my soiled laundry? Now, with the four types that we've discussed, you can see that there are vast differences in the four types. Here, she emphasizes the fact that each of these types has value, right? That's the point of her essay. That there are so many different shapes, forms, flavors, and usages, but at the core is the same essential property, droplets of water. So despite our differences, in spite of our upbringing, our background, our worldview, our religious perspective, our color, our culture, our education, what we do for a living, in spite of all of those things, we all contain the same essential property, which, in the case of her example, is droplets of water. And, of course, that happens to be true for us, too. And you are probably aware of the fact that we are mostly made up of water, right? There is a lot of water that makes us up. And, of course, the water that makes up me is identical to the water that makes up you. This is an important principle that we have talked about many times before. In the past, when we have talked about it before, I have emphasized 1 Corinthians chapter 12. Just as a body, though one has many parts, but all its many parts form one body. That's the way it is with us, right? We are connected together in a way that we cannot do without each other. And frankly, I'm a little baffled by how difficult a concept this is for some people to grasp or to appreciate. Because to me, it seems like one of the most self-evident truths that exist, right? But for what it's worth, I wanted to talk about something else here. In Matthew 10 is a description of those disciples who were called by Yeshua to walk with him, to be discipled by him. What's interesting, of course, is that Yeshua calls 12 apostles. It corresponds, obviously, to the 12 tribes of Israel. First is Simon, who is called Peter, his brother Andrew, James, the son of Zebedee, and his brother John. It's interesting because James is called the son of Zebedee, and his brother John is added. Instead of saying James and John, the sons of Zebedee, as you would expect it to say. So there's something worth exploring in this verse. We're not going to talk about it now, but it's interesting. Philip and Bartholomew, or Nathanael, Bartholomew is also known as Nathanael, Thomas and Matthew, and notice, it doesn't mention what any of them did for a living before they were called, with the exception of Matthew, the tax collector. Right? So, I'm not sure why Matthew includes that here when he doesn't identify what anybody else does for a living, but it's probably Matthew's way of saying, "Oh, the tax collector." Right? It's his way of expressing his astonishment that Yeshua would have called him. James, the son of Alphaeus, obviously you were aware of the fact that tax collectors had a very bad reputation in first century Israel. James, the son of Alphaeus and Thaddeus. Simon, interestingly enough, is referred to as a zealot. And Judas Iscariot, who betrayed him. Zealotry was obviously not an occupation. It was a religious perspective, but it's interesting. The point of mentioning them and talking about what we know about them from other passages has to do with the fact that even though the majority of them were fishermen, the fact of the matter is that they were all very different from each other. We read about Simon called Peter and his brother Andrew's calling in Matthew 4. They were casting a net into the lake, for they were fishermen. And Yeshua said to them, "Come, follow me." And they do. Also in Matthew 4, here is another mention of James, the son of Zebedee, and his brother John. They are also fishermen. When Yeshua calls them, they are in a boat fishing with their father. They're preparing to cast their nets into the water. It is possible that Philip, Thomas, and Nathanael were also fishermen. So at least seven of the disciples were fishermen. It's interesting because we know that Matthew, of course, was a tax collector. And Judas may have been an accountant or a bookkeeper prior to his association with Yeshua, because he's the one who kept the purse, right? It's possible that he could have been assigned to keep the purse no matter what he did before, but it's possible that he had a background in bookkeeping or accounting that made it worthwhile for him to do that. What's interesting, of course, has to do with the fact that these disciples, with the exception of Matthew, would not have been considered schooled or educated by the religious leadership in Jerusalem. And, of course, Judas could have been an exception to that rule too, right? But when they are referred to as unschooled and ordinary men, it doesn't mean that they were unschooled. It just means, according to the standards of the religious leadership in Jerusalem, they were regarded, there's a term for them, but they were regarded, I'll use the colloquial expression in English, they were regarded as country bumpkins. Okay? You're probably familiar with that expression. You perhaps have heard it before. But the fact of the matter is that they were educated. They were observant. Am ha'aretz is the Hebrew expression, people of the land. It is sometimes used in a derogatory way of country folk. But what's interesting about it has to do with the fact that it has been discovered that country folk were actually more observant. They were closer to God, were more observant, they tended to be not quite as strict as the religious leaders in Jerusalem were, right? Regardless of whether they were Sadducees or Pharisees or scribes. But the fact of the matter is that they emphasized to a greater extent the spirit of the Torah in their lives, as opposed to just emphasizing the letter, right? So it provides an explanation why Yeshua selected them. But the fact of the matter is, they were just regular people, like me, like you, right? And yet, they were regarded as having the ability to make a great contribution to the Messiah's work. Now, what is also true of Yeshua's disciples, that there were many women involved among his disciples as well. In this passage in Luke 8, after this, Yeshua traveled about from one town to another, from one town and village to another, proclaiming the good news of the kingdom. The 12 were with him, and also some women who had been cured of evil spirits and diseases. Mary, called Magdalene, from whom 7 demons had come out. By the way, Mary is never referred to as a prostitute in the apostolic literature. She doesn't become a prostitute until about the 3rd and 4th centuries, right? She's identified as a prostitute in the writings of the early church fathers, not in the Bible. She is an individual who had 7 demons cast out of her. Joanna, the wife of Chuza, the manager of Herod's household, Susanna, and many others. And notice it says these women were helping to support them out of their own means, which is obviously an indication that women, in the Jewish community at the first century at least, had their own means. They had their own bank accounts. They had the ability to own property. Their property did not automatically automatically absorbed by their fathers, by their husbands, into their husbands' households, like was true in Greek and Roman culture. It's interesting because these women also, we don't know much about them, but the fact of the matter is that these women played a significant role in Yeshua's ministry. By the way, there are 6 Marys mentioned in the apostolic writings. Mary Magdalene, the one we just read about, she's the first one to see the Messiah after his resurrection, and she refers to him as Rabboni, my master or my teacher. The first one, a woman, was the first one to see the resurrected Messiah. And frankly, when Peter and John get there, John is very excited about Mary's testimony, but Peter ignores it, right? He has to run into the tomb to see for himself if whether or not the body is there. Mary, the mother of Yeshua, the wife of Joseph, related by marriage to Elizabeth, her Hebrew name is Elisheva, Mary of Bethany, the sister of Lazarus and Martha, Mary, the wife of Clopas, the sister-in-law of Mary, Yeshua's mother. There is also another Mary in the Acts, the mother of John, also called Mark, who facilitated the gathering of a community in her home, right? We don't know anything about her husband, except that he was Greek. But the fact of the matter is that they probably did not see eye to eye on religious matters. But the husband, in this case at least, tolerated the gathering of the community in their home, right? But this statement probably indicates that Mary, who gathered the community in her home, played an instrumental role in facilitating the existence of this community, right? And Mary, the last Mary, who worked very hard for the Kehila, for the congregation in Rome, right? So I guess my point is that in spite of our great differences, regardless of whether we are men or women, regardless of our education, regardless of a whole variety of things, we can play a meaningful role in how the community functions, right? We can play a part in the way the community functions. And the fact of the matter is that we shouldn't let anyone take that away from us, right? There's a wonderful passage in Malachi, in which Malachi says, "Do not we all have one Father? Did not God create us? Why do we profane the covenant of our ancestors by being unfaithful to one another? Isn't my Father the same as your Father? Didn't God create you in the same way He created me?" I mean, if that's the case, then this idea that we are many parts of one body, which Paul emphasizes in his letter to the Corinthians, is just, I want to say it's a profound idea, but it's not. It's not a gestalt. You know, it's a, come on, why is this so hard for us to see, to recognize? By the way, I wanted to share a number of quotes from various sources. The first is from a character named Jaya in The Storyteller's Secret by Sajal Bendani. "The same blood runs in every human on the earth. You just have to see past the variations in skin and culture, right, to recognize that we're all the same on the inside." Of course, Chaya, or Hannah, emphasizes the water. Ajaya emphasizes the blood. A book called A Severe Mercy by Sheldon Van Auken. "It is, I think, that we are all so alone in what lies deepest in our souls, so unable to find the words and perhaps the courage to speak with unlocked hearts, that we do not know at all that it is the same with others." From William Shakespeare, this is a quote from King Henry in his work Henry V. "I think the king is but a man, as I am. The violet smells to him as it doth to me." Right? This next quote is from a book called Wild at Heart by John Eldridge. "Every man carries a wound. I have never met a man without one. No matter how good your life may have seemed to you, You live in a broken world, full of broken people. And finally, from Diary of an Oxygen Thief, this work is anonymous, you might as well argue with a mirror as argue with each other. After all, aren't we all really the same person? Right? I mean, these quotes are very powerful. They express this idea that in spite of our superficial differences, inside we are really all the same. Okay? So, I wanted to emphasize something else about this passage. I wanted to talk for a few minutes about the actual rebellion itself. Hannah mentions that Korach incited a mutiny against Moses. Joining Korach were 250 distinguished members of the community who offered the sacrosanct ketoret incense to prove their worthiness from the priest for the priesthood, claiming that the entire nation and not just Aaron or the priests is holy. So this is the second account of a presumptuous, unprincipled rebellion against Moses by leading figures who were not content to continue in subservient positions under Moses' leadership. So the first, of course, involves Miriam and Aaron. You're probably familiar with it, so I'm going to skip over the reading of the text. But of course they say, hasn't the Lord also spoken through us? The Lord spoke through both Miriam and Aaron. You know, the Lord did speak through them. But there is a difference between the Lord speaking through you and the Lord raising you up to be the leader over God's people, right? And frankly, in my opinion, we should, bless God profusely when He uses us to speak, right? And not presume that that means that we have been called to something else, right? It might not. At any rate, of course, it is Miriam's attack. Aaron joined at her instigation. She watched when Moses was placed into the Nile, made it possible for Moses' true mother to nurse him when he was adopted by Pharaoh's daughter, and of course she led the singing and the dancing that took place just after the children of Israel passed through the Red Sea, right? So, she had some grounds for imagining or for thinking, you know, that the Lord was using her too in the same way He was using Moses. Of course, she is smitten with leprosy. She is put outside the camp for 7 days, but Moses intercedes on her behalf and arranges for the community not to move until she was brought back. Okay? So, moving on in Numbers chapter 16 has to do with the rebellion of Korach itself and certain Reubenites. Moses was the son of Amram, the son of Levi. Thus, Korach and Moses were cousins, just from a different family. Apparently, the Reubenites could not forget that theirs was the eldest tribe, and from it the rulers of Israel should have been recruited. But, of course, the Bible explains why the rights of the firstborn were taken from Reuben and given to Joseph, right? So Reuben forfeited this right in the community. According to the rabbis, the men of Reuben and Levi and Reuben came to join forces because they always camped and marched next to each other. So if you look at the chart below, it shows the way the community was organized as they traveled through the wilderness. If you look on the east, you'll see that there are three tribes that make up the eastern camp, three tribes that make up the northern camp, three tribes that make up the western camp, and three tribes that make up the southern camp. The leader of the eastern camp is Judah, the northern camp is Dan, the western camp is Ephraim, and the southern camp is Reuben. But notice that next to Reuben are the Kohathites. The Kohathites and the Reubenites marched through the wilderness together, right, side by side. And Kohath is the family that Korach and some of his company come from. At any rate, the text also goes on to describe that with them were 200 Israelite men, well-known community leaders. But of course, this translation, well-known community leaders, doesn't reflect what the Hebrew actually says. They're called Anshei Shem, men of name. But of course, it's translated correctly, because that's what this means. It could have been translated, with them were 200 Israelite men, well-known men of good reputations, or, you know, men with authority, because that's what the word name in Hebrew means. But this was not a rebellion of rude, impudent scoundrels, but of credible leaders, esteemed men of rank. Both Moses and Aaron were in their 80s at the time. The nation was under the sentence of God's judgment. They knew that they were all going to die in the wilderness. Perhaps they thought if they could join, if they could force a change of guard, they might reverse the judgment too. Regardless, they came as a group. This was an organized, well-thought-out conspiracy. They were not content with the privilege they had already received. Petty, insecure people will always rise up against constituted leadership, pushing and pressing to assert their own agenda. Of course, they come as a group to Moses, who responds, "You have gone too far." But looking in the Psalms, it talks about the fact that in the camp, Korach, Datan, Aviram, and On, the leaders of the rebellion, they grew envious of Moses, right? But if you look at different translations, in some translations, the word is translated jealous. They were jealous of Moses. There's an important distinction in Scripture between envy and jealousy, although the same word, kana, is used. Envy is when you want something that belongs to someone else. Jealousy is when you want something that someone else has that belongs to you. Right? Sometimes there's a fine line between these two things. That's why, by the way, we talked a couple of weeks ago about the woman suspected of adultery, the sota. Her husband was jealous. Right? And properly so, because he was suspicious that she had lain with another man. Right? That intimacy is something that belongs to him. So he was jealous when he was suspicious that someone else was the object of it. And in the Scriptures, God speaks of himself being jealous, right? The people worship false gods. It's a problem because God has the right to expect that we as his people worship him and not gods of wood and stone, right? But there are many occasions in the Scripture where these words are used. Sometimes it's a little difficult to distinguish which of the definitions is more appropriate. Korach, Datan, Abiram, and On, they were envious of the authority that Moses had, right? They wanted it for themselves. In Acts 7, it speaks of the fact that the patriarchs were jealous of Joseph. That's why they sold him as a slave into Egypt, right? But it too was because Joseph was favored by their father, and it became very obvious to the brothers that Joseph, one of the youngest of the sons, was going to be put into a position of priority and authority over them. And frankly, that troubled them, right? Jealousy is what fostered the insolence of Korach and Datan and Abiram and On, and what fostered the insolence on the part of Joseph's brothers. Insolence is showing an aggressive lack of respect in speech or behavior, right? It's translated by a variety of different words. But the fact of the matter is that this is what Paul, in his letter to the Romans, cautions the Gentile believers in the Messiah. He cautions them against being insolent or disrespectful against the Jewish people, right? He says in this passage, a passage that you are familiar with, "Do not consider yourself to be superior to those other branches. If you do consider this, you do not support the root, but the root supports you." He says, "Don't be arrogant, but tremble." I mean, if God was not willing to spare the natural branches, what makes you think that his attitudes towards you, the wild branches, will be any different? Okay? So I want to conclude with this emphasis. The whole community is holy. What Korach, a true demagogue, emphasized was true. But what was the point of mentioning that the whole community is holy? Did Korach think that being set apart qualified someone to lead the community? Did he think that anyone set apart could lead if he or she wanted to? Should anyone set apart have the right to lead? What he really meant? Moses, who put you in charge? The whole community is holy. That includes me. I am just as holy as you are. Therefore, I have as much right to lead as you do. The fact of the matter is the whole community is holy. But that doesn't change the relative obligations that we've been given, the relative responsibilities. We are not all called to do the same thing, right? That's the bottom line. We are all set apart by God. We are all considered holy. We're all saints as far as God is concerned. But that doesn't mean we have the same skill set or the same gifts, right? Or the same calling, right? We are all called to different things. And finally, it can be easily seen that what Korach resented regarding the leadership of Moses is what he wanted for himself, right? And this is an interesting aspect too, because Korach acted, he disliked a quality that he perceived Moses exhibited, but was actually true of himself. And when it comes to judgment, that is something, according to the scriptures, that we have to be careful of. There's an important passage in the Jerusalem Talmud. Korach declared, and this is on the last page of your notes, "The Torah was not given by God, Moses is not a prophet, and Aaron is not the high priest." Now, I want to be careful with the way I say this, but I want you to give some thought to this idea. This is obviously not true of all Christians, but in my view, it is true of Christianity generally. It could be argued that Christianity has joined Korach's rebellion by emphasizing the same theological conclusions. And the summary points are these. Even though the Torah is believed to be God-given, it is considered to be a burdensome maze of laws, many obscured by the tradition of men, and rules that condemn, not intended for believers. Though everyone readily admits that Moses was a prophet, his prophecy is lowly regarded. He is considered a prophet made irrelevant by later prophets who saw with greater revelation. Moses is so diminished in his office of prophet that it is as if he were not a prophet at all. His words are largely ignored. And Aaron's priesthood was replaced with Yeshua's. When Messiah came as high priest of the good things that are already here, he went through the greater and more perfect tabernacle that is not man-made. That is to say, not a part of this creation. So, of course, the point of the author of Hebrews is not that the covenant, the Mosaic covenant, which includes the role of the priest, the place of the Torah, and the place of the sacrifices, is not done away with in the Messiah. His whole point is that the priesthood of the Messiah reflects the priesthood of Aaron. The sacrifice of the Messiah reflects the sacrifice of Aaron. All of the aspects of the Messiah reflect the good things that are already here. And the fact of the matter is, the good things that are already here are good, right? It's just that our connection with the Messiah facilitates our ability to get to the Olam Haba, the world to come, to being in God's presence, when the work of the tabernacle and the temple, the earthly tabernacle and the temple, are primarily designed for our earthly relationship with God. It's the work that the Messiah does on our behalf that facilitates our connection to God, not only in this world, but more importantly, in the world to come. So, I'm going to stop here and see if there are any comments or questions about what we've discussed. These are obviously important issues. Anybody?
Melody and I were reflecting during the lesson just how timely this parsha is. We are in such a world that's polarized.
Yeah.
And a time where leadership themselves, in different contexts, are grappling with one another and accusing each other. And then we have others who it seems as if their desire is to discredit anyone who is a leader. And so the timing, I think, of this parsha, and it's not, this is not a unique statement to this parsha.
No.
I continue to be amazed at the timeliness of the parshas from week to week.
Yeah.
But this is the case here. And, you know, we have other evolving language and terminologies that speak to what we're talking about here. It's not particularly common, but it's growing, is the idea of implicit bias.
Yes.
And so there are efforts to raise a consciousness and awareness of implicit bias. But I just found the whole lesson very interesting and intriguing. And I echo your comments there at the end that Christianity in general may in fact be guilty of joining the rebellion of Korach. Melody and I both are former staff members of one of the largest congregations in North America, a church that has over 40,000 members. And the founding pastor of that church a few years ago made a public statement that was broadcasted that in his opinion the book of Leviticus would have been best to have been left out of the Bible. And that was what those were his exact words. And that fits the description that you just gave, that Moses is not a prophet, and the Torah is not from God. I mean, that's, there it is. That's it. And that might not represent everybody, but we've heard that from the most one of the more influential congregations in North America.
Yeah.
So I have a question, but it's going to be my question is outside this lesson, so I'm going to hold it until others have had an opportunity to discuss this. And if we have time, I'll bring my question in.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your comments. You know, it is sad, but I have heard statements like that made as well. It's something that, you know, that it's hard to describe the degree to which it grieves me to hear things like that. For those of you who were a part of our study on the canon, the Torah that Moses provided his people with was regarded as authoritative and inspired immediately, right? I mean, I don't know how many people are aware of this, but, you know, but the apostolic canon was not ratified until the end of the 4th century, right? Over 300 years after Yeshua lived. The United States has not even been a country for 300 years, right? Of course, with regard to the Hebrew Bible, you know, the books were collected over a significant period of time, over 1,000 years. But in the book of Joshua, there are many references to the Torah of Moses, right? Moses wrote the Torah, all 5 books. Moses passed those books along to his people. They were regarded as inspired, authoritative. In fact, there are so many references in the Bible to the fact that people did something in a particular way in order to fulfill what Moses spoke about in the Torah, right? And this is true, frankly, for the apostolic literature, too. You remember the leper that asked Yeshua to touch him, and he does. But what does he tell the leper? Don't tell anybody. Because even though you're clean, you're healed, you're not clean until the priest says you're clean, right? I mean, he says, go to the temple, do what Moses requires of you at your cleansing, right? I mean, it's just so sad that that people are so willing to exclude portions of the Bible that doesn't fit their theology, rather than trying to make their theology fit what the Bible teaches. Martin Luther didn't think the book of James should be in the apostolic literature, right? Because he had a theological problem with it. So it must not be part of the... It shouldn't have been included in the Bible, right? I know people who think that the letters of Paul shouldn't be in the Bible, right? Because of the way they read them. That Paul is responsible for Christianity. But of course, that is not the case, right? The early church fathers are responsible for Christianity. And Paul was dead for 125 years, or 100 years, by the time Christianity develops, right? It's just sad. But I appreciate you bringing it up. It's important to talk about. Any other comments before we go? I see there's a few chats. Any other comments before we go? Either about what we discussed or Roderick's contribution. Let me read the chats real quickly. Rivka was earlier talking about the heat strokes, and Susanna mentioned something about the temperature. So Rivka writes, ice cubes in the armpit can save a life. It immediately drops body temperature. How hot is it in Israel this time of year? From Susanna. Depends on where you are. Parts of Israel can be very hot in the Negev. It's not uncommon for the temperatures to be well over 100 degrees too. But at higher elevations, like in the north, the weather is more temperate. So in some parts of the country, it can be humid and hot. Other parts of the country, it can be cooler. Depends on where you are. Mount Hermon, for example, has snow on it much of the year. It's about a little over 10,000 feet. So from Joseph, good teaching. Thank you. From Avid, thank you for the lesson. Abba, I love you a lot. See you next week. Very good. I think Avid has already had to go. From Rivka, I always appreciate the defining of jealousy versus envy, since Hashem says, I am a jealous God. I figure jealousy isn't a bad thing, but envy is, right? That's correct. From Susanna, how do the four types often used in Jewish teaching fit in with the species used at Sukkot, right? It's the same. The willow, the citron, the palm, and the myrtle. Those four species that we bring to Sukkot speak of the four kinds of Jews. So that's correct. And she adds that in Christianity, Moses represents the law and that it is a burden. Which is the word I hear most frequently associated with the Torah in Christian circles, is that the Torah is a burden. Even though it's obviously not characterized like that in the Bible itself. Anywhere in the Bible, for that matter. And from Elaine, thank you for this teaching. My pleasure. Appreciate you being here. Any other comments now before we go?
I'm doing a study in the year of the Bible, and I'm in Leviticus right now, but I'm also doing, like, my devotional is on YouTube. It's called the Bible Project.
Yeah.
And so you're familiar with that?
Yes.
Okay, so they've been breaking it down, and before, when I used to read it in Leviticus, I was like, man, why do they have all these laws and about the cleanliness and all of this? But listening to them, it was really important and pertinent to the survival of how the people lived back in that time with sickness and disease and leprosy and, you know, the women having their menstrual cycle. So as I was listening to my devotion this morning and was listening to them and how they were explaining it, it just fits. You can't have Leviticus without, you can't take that book out because it's so important to the survival of the Hebrew people. You just can't do it. So I'm really thankful for the teaching and just having a different mindset, a different view, because I've heard that too. I've heard that, you know, the Torah is the law, and if you live by the law, you're going to die by the law, and, you know, Yeshua ushered in grace, so we're under the dispensation of grace. But when you read Leviticus and all the other books in the beginning, they're all just talking about Yeshua.
Yeah. Well, you know what's interesting with regard to the dispensation of grace is every apostolic example of God's grace uses a figure from the Hebrew Bible to prove it, you know, which has always been a great irony to me, right? Every apostolic author that talks about God's grace uses an example of God's grace, how God works in the lives of an individual or his people from the Bible, from the Hebrew Bible, right? The dispensation of law, right? So obviously, grace and law go together in the thinking of apostolic authors. They're not opposites like they are in the thinking process or the theology of Christianity. In Christianity, law and grace are opposites. In Jewish theology, law and grace go together. Which, by the way, is one of the most significant lessons from the fact that the Holy Spirit was poured out on the day of Pentecost in Acts chapter 2, a holiday which commemorates the giving of the Torah, right? It's not an accident that that occurred like that. So, I appreciate the comment. By the way, one of my most favorite chapters in all of the Bible is in Leviticus 19, which is the middle chapter of the Torah. And it's as if the whole Torah turns on the teaching in Leviticus 19. It's really, it's quite remarkable and obviously speaks about God's relationship with his people and his care for them.
That'll be my study for tomorrow's devotion.
Oh, good. Good. So Joseph writes that law and grace are partners, very much so, in biblical theology. Susanna makes an observation that during the bubonic plague, or the Black Plague, Jewish communities were not as affected by the bubonic plague as others were because of their adherence to Torah. That is true. Unfortunately, as a result of the fact that they were not as affected by it in the same way as others, it was blamed on them. Right? So, the bubonic plague was blamed by many on the Jewish community because they were not affected by it in the same way as others, and it is because of their hygienic and dietary practices. That's the last of the chats. Any other comments before we go?
Angie has a question.
Okay, go ahead.
Hi, Bob. I'm just curious about that canon that we're given today and your view on it. The books that were left out, do you think that was done as maybe part of an agenda? Or, I mean, what are your thoughts on the books that were left out?
In my opinion, the books that were left out should have been left out, which, by the way, is the subject of the seminar we are doing now on Thursday nights. The seminar on Thursday night is a brief survey of the intertestamental period literature. And so we are talking about the books that were written or authored between the close of the Hebrew canon and the ratification of the apostolic canon, right? So, much of those books are Jewish literature. in this seminar, we're talking about 110 books. About 70 of them are related to the Hebrew Bible, and about 30 or so are related to the apostolic literature. But one of the things that we talked about in the canon study, which just concluded Thursday night, we talked about the process, how the canon came to be, and particularly with the apostolic literature, because there was a great deal of controversy regarding it. There were books that were actually included in lists of works that were considered to be inspired. But then when the canon was actually ratified, many of those books were left out for reasons, unfortunately, reasons that we are not always aware, right? But we are going to be talking about all of those books in our study on Thursday night. And we are going to look at excerpts from all of the books, and we're going to talk about each of the books individually, discuss how the theology contained in these books is not biblical. It does not fit what we know of the Bible's teaching from other books. And the fact of the matter is that we don't know who the authors of any of these books are. We know who they purport to be written by, but none of the books that were excluded from the canon, we don't know who the author of any of those books are, right? They pretend to be written by someone, but in most cases, the people that they pretend to have been written by were dead for between 200 and 600 years, right? So it's a problem. Because of how important, and this is a principle of hermeneutics, the text means what the text meant when the original author wrote to the original audience. If you don't know who the original author is, it's difficult to assess who the original audience is, right? And so those works are have been considered spurious, which, by the way, doesn't mean that the information they contain isn't valuable. Just because a work is not inspired does not necessarily mean that the information it contains can't help us to appreciate the development of biblical theology, which in many cases they do, right? For better or for worse, by the way. Sometimes we can see the development of harmful theological views by studying the intertestamental period literature. So that's the subject of our study on Thursday night, and as you can imagine, it's probably going to take us a few weeks to get through 110 books. So we'll be studying that material for several months. Right? Good. Appreciate the question. Yes, go ahead, Amy.
Do you have to be a member to join into the class or just to get the...
No, you just have to go onto the website and get the link.
Okay.
It does help. You do need the workbook, which is available online.
Right.
You do need the workbook because we are reading about each of the works and reading quotes from each of the works, and we're comparing, in some cases, those quotes to either biblical or apostolic literature, right? So it's helpful to know what we're talking about. But anybody can join the classes. They just have to get the link online. They go to the upcoming events page on the website, enjoin.
But what about the previous teachings that you've already done on that?
You do have to be a basic member to have access to the Torah studies, and a premium member to have access to the Wednesday and Thursday night studies.
Which I have.
Yeah. So.
That,
and then if you're a premium member, you have access to everything. And you get a discount on the cost of material. So, we appreciate both basic and premium memberships, frankly. That is the only source of income that Ashab Books has, right? Aside from contributions that people make from time to time, but apart from unsolicited contributions, that's the only source of revenue that Ashab Books has, the basic and premium members, their membership. So it's a very much appreciated. Okay, any other comments before we go?
I'll bring my question up.
Okay.
I'm not interrupting anyone, but Bob, my question has to do with current events that are happening in Israel. We've all been, I'm sure, watching and trying to, at the same time, filter information, looking for what is trustworthy. But in light of the increase of violence coming from Gaza into Israel, now on top of that, we are seeing a big change in the government of Israel. And my question is a simple question, but the answer is going to be very complex. And so I'm waiting with bated breath. What does all this mean?
Well, unfortunately, you're right. That the response to that is complicated. The greatest source of frustration, in my opinion, comes from the fact that in the last, 2 years, there have been 4 elections in Israel. In each of the elections, the party that Bibi Netanyahu represents has acquired the most seats in the Knesset. For those of you who are not aware, Israel is a parliamentary democracy. There are many, many political parties in Israel. There aren't just 2 or 3. There's several. When Israel goes to the polls, they do not elect individuals. They support parties. Right? And so, the party, there are 120 seats in the Knesset. And so, any party, in order to govern effectively, has to control at least 61 seats. Unfortunately, no political party has acquired 61 seats as a result of the popular election. I can't remember the last time when that occurred, right? So, what happens is that if a party acquires 40 seats as a result of the elections, that it has to put together a coalition of other parties who also control seats, right? So in other words, ideally, Likud, say, who controls 40 seats, would align themselves with a party that controls 21 seats. And those two parties would form a government. Netanyahu, because his party has 40 seats, he would become the prime minister. And the other party, who would join his government, would only join if they were given what are called portfolios. They are called other ministries, like the Ministry of Defense, the Ministry of the Interior, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, other ministries that play key roles in the way the government works, right? So, unfortunately, in the last four elections, Likud has acquired more seats than any other government, right? But they have failed to put together a coalition with Israel's other parties, right? So, in each of the cases in the last 2 years, in their attempt to form a government, Likud has failed. And what happens is, after a certain period of time, when it becomes obvious that there is not enough, there isn't enough of a willingness to participate in a coalition government, right? Either because the parties are too far apart politically or philosophically, or they are not given control over ministries that they think they should be, they don't have the ability to form a government, and new elections are called. The objective of the new elections is with the hope that one party will acquire a majority, and that majority will be able to form a government. Okay? So, in each of the previous elections, that has not been the case. Now, Likud, in each of the previous four elections, has amassed a increasing number of seats in the Knesset, right? But they have still not been able to form a government. This is the first time in my recollection when, since the party with the most seats in the Knesset has not been able to form a government, the president of the country has asked the party with the second greatest number of seats to attempt to form a government. But of course, in this case, without the party that has the most seats, Likud, right? So, that's what we are in the process of going through at the moment. The party with the second most seats is trying to form a government, and if you have been following the news in the last several weeks, there have been times when it looks like an arrangement has been reached that will allow them to form a government, and it has looked like negotiations have broken down and they aren't able to form a government after all. But what this means for Likud is that Benjamin Netanyahu will, his 12-year rule as prime minister will come to an end, because he obviously won't be the prime minister if a coalition is organized without Likud involved. Okay? Now, what complicates this is what is going on with Gaza. Likud is regarded as the most conservative of the parties and is willing to take a hard view with regard to the over 4,500 missiles that have been launched into Israel. And by the way, those missiles do not target military targets, are not military. the targets are civilian. They're all civilian targets. They just target Israeli cities, right? They just launch these missiles in the hopes that they destroy something or set something on fire or disrupt the lives of the people in Israel. So there is a great concern in Israel at the moment how a new government would respond to a provocation like that. There is very little question how Benjamin Netanyahu would respond to a provocation like that, because we've seen the way he responds to that kind of provocation in the past, including in this most recent volley of rockets, right? So in Israel at the moment, there is a great deal of unease with regard to the formation of a government, who will be the next prime minister, who will fulfill the various roles in the government, and of course, the fact of the matter is that whatever government forms without Likud, it does not reflect the desire on the greatest majority in the country that supported Likud. Right, so you can see that it's a recipe for political upheaval, right? Because with every election, Likud acquires a greater number of seats. So that means, by definition, that when most Israelis go to the polls, most of them, the Likud has received the greatest popular support in the country. But because he has been prime minister for so long, the other political parties who in the past may have been willing to govern with him are not anymore. They feel there needs to be a change in the prime minister, right? So that's kind of what we're dealing with at the moment. To my knowledge, a government has still not yet been formed, right? And the new government, one last observation, the people who are attempting to put together the new government are soliciting the support of the Arab List, which has 12 seats in the Knesset, right? Unfortunately, the Arab representatives in the Knesset have been increasingly opposed to the Israeli government in their rhetoric and in their political views, and so it's hard to imagine how that would be a good thing. So,
thank you so much, Bob. This was helpful. I know it's about, in some ways, politics.
Yeah.
But I believe it's also relevant. And thank you for taking the time to help us.
Yeah, my pleasure. By the way, if you're interested in listening to discussions about this, you can tune in to Israel National Radio. And there's a couple of rabbis who have programs on this subject, Jeremy Gimpel and Ari Abramovitz, who are both rabbis. I happen to know them both, and so they will have good things to say about this issue. It's frankly disheartening, right? To and you can only imagine the kind of conflict in the country this generates, right? So, anyway, any other comments before we go?
It sort of sounds a little bit like America.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. Except the nation is not quite as polarized as is the United States, right? But that's because we have, you know, basically two parties. There are other parties, of course, but their influence, even though, you know, there are some representatives in Congress that represent other parties, but you know, they're not particularly influential. So the United States has become very polarized politically, right? So in Israel, there are more political options, a lot more political options, right? But those political options result in the inability of any particular party to form a government without making deals with other parties so that they can rule, right? So that they can control a majority of the seats in the Knesset, right? Years ago, this was not an issue. It's become increasingly more and more a bigger and bigger problem every year. So, by the way, Elaine wrote earlier, or Rivka wrote, "It is so good," referring to the Thursday night study. We've just started, by the way, on Thursday nights. I think this is the third or fourth week, fifth maybe. From Elaine, "Yes, Rivka, it is so good." From Benita, "Thank you." That may have referred to the description of what's going on in Israel. Any other comments before we go? Yeah, the political situation in Israel and frankly in the United States is very disheartening. Sad to watch. Okay, that's it. No other comments, questions before we go? Are you waving goodbye or are you raising your hand? Waving goodbye. Okay. Okay, you guys, God bless you. May the Lord be with you. And I pray that the Lord would bless the rest of your Shabbat and bless you with a good week coming up this week. And Lord willing, I will see you on Wednesday we're finishing up our study on idioms. On Thursday, we have just started our study on the intertestamental period literature. It promises to be very, very interesting. So I'm very much looking forward to the time we spend together on Thursday night. So, God bless you guys. May the Lord be with you.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thanks. Thanks for sharing your Shabbat afternoon with us. Good night, Lila Tov.
Lila Tov, good night.
May the Lord be with you.
And you also.
Thank you.
We're praying for Israel.
Amen. Thank you. I appreciate it. Anxious to go.
One day, when it's time.
Yeah, when it's time. Hopefully sooner rather than later.
Thank you, everybody.
Thanks, Ed. God bless you guys. Thanks, Elaine. Good to see everybody.